There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer." The manager said to himself, "What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 3,000 liters of olive oil," he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly and make it 1,500. Then he asked the second, "How much do you owe?" 30 tons of wheat," he replied. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 24. The master commended the dishonest manager, because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. He said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others, but God knows your hearts. What people value highly is detestable in God's sight. The law and the prophets were proclaimed until John. Since that time, the good news of the kingdom of God is being preached, and everyone is forcing their way into it. It is easier for heaven and earth to disappear than for the least stroke of a pen to drop out of the law. Anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery. And the man who marries a divorced woman commits adultery."
Whilst you're waiting for the band to take a seat, what I'd like you to do is to find your wallet or your purse and just get it out of your pocket right now. If you haven't, give money. And then what I'd like you to do is just give it to the person next door to you. And now what I'd like you to do is to give as you've never given before. And just delight in doing so. It felt good for a moment, didn't it? My son gave me a card this morning. He said, "Father, I've learned how to save. I just spend your money." And often it reveals, isn't it, giving and money and wealth where we are. And that desire to quick to give away others, but a little bit maybe quicker to hold on to our own. In all seriousness, what I would like you to do is just turn to the person next to you and tell them how much you earn. And how much you give. Now, some of you are thinking right now, there's just no way that I'm going to do that. And you're going to say to me, "Mark, biblically, you're the right hand and the left hand, they're not to know what each one is to give." And I'd say, you're absolutely right. But some of you were fearful just for a moment just then, because you were thinking, "I don't want to reveal how much I give, because maybe I don't give as much as I should and I know it." Maybe you were just a little bit embarrassed. Maybe you just didn't know, or you haven't given, or not giving. Or maybe you're just not stewarding your money in the way that you think, maybe that's right. And of course, what we do with our money and what we do with our worldly wealth and how we use it and what's its purpose, it reveals who I truly love. It reveals what I love. It reveals whose authority I'm accepting and who I'm listening to. See, in the preceding chapters to ours this morning, Jesus has been outlining about discipleship. So back in chapter 14, 25, he's outlined the cost of discipleship, taking up one's cross and following him, having ears to hear and listening to him. Then in chapter 15, a couple of weeks ago, we saw God's heart for the lost, that call to repent, to come back to him. That's how discipleship begins. And now Jesus moves into this kind of big area of discipleship, of following him. What do we do with our money? What do we do with our worldly wealth? How do we use it? What's its purpose? And you might be tempted to think, well, that's a funny place to start, Jesus. You've gone from this great passage and parables of Luke 15 of the welcoming love of the Father to talking about money and this shrewd manager. Except, of course, that in the parable of the lost son, we saw both the younger son and the eldest son more concerned about stuff than they were with their relationship with their father. They were more concerned about wealth. They were more concerned about living for the now than a relationship with the Father and eternal things. And stuff and worldly wealth and living for the now is just one of the big blockers, the big hindrances, the big temptations to following Christ wholeheartedly. And it's nothing new. We're tempted to think it's just kind of a modern age kind of problem. You know, it's just our age. It's consumed with stuff and living for the moment. But of course, the truth is, it was an Israelite problem as well. It's always been a big human problem. You think about who the Israelites worshipped. They worshipped other gods. What were the gods they worshipped? They worshipped the gods of Baal. Who were the gods of Baal? They were the gods of prosperity, of wealth. They were seeking comfort now and stuff now to be able to live better now. That's why they went to the worship in the gods of the Baal. They wanted more and they wanted to live for the now. It's always been an issue. And Jesus, it seems, with that in mind, speaks into it. He tells this parable, the parable of the shrewd manager. Have a look with me. There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer." And this manager, knowing he's about to be sacked, thinks to himself, not strong enough to dig, too proud, too ashamed to beg. You know, he's the kind of man with manicured nails, he's too good to work, too proud to get down and labor hard. So he thinks to himself, verse 4, "I know what I'll do. So that when I lose my job, people will welcome me into their home." And so he connects with people who are in debt to the rich man. And he discounts their debt so that they are in debt to him. That they'll welcome him. He'll freeload off them or work for them. Who knows? So he calls in the first guy. Verse 5. "How much do you owe?" He knows how much this guy owes, but he wants this bloke to say it so they feel much more the discount. That they feel that he's done something for them. The bloke says 3,000 litres, says the first one. Literally 3 years' salary it would have been. And the manager says, "Take your bill, write it down quickly, one time, offer only." I get the impression he's from Essex, I don't know why, maybe it's just me. Boom. Make it 1,500, 50% discount. Second guy comes in, "How much do you owe?" "I owe 30 tons of wheat, equivalent to 8 years' debt." "Take your bill, make it 24, one time, offer only, 20% discount." Now, we're not told why the discount's different. Theories abound on the reasons, and theories abound on whose pocket is affected by the discounts. Is the manager kind of cutting his share that would have been given to him? Probably not. It's too much. More likely what he's doing, he's taking from the master again, which then makes what the master says in verse 8 even more shocking. Look what he says, verse 8. "The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly." He's not commending him for his dishonesty, but for his shrewdness, his wisdom, his practical judgment. Now the danger is we get hung up on the detail of this parable. It's just a parable. We don't need to explain every part or equate every part to us and what it means to follow Jesus. Jesus tells us the point of the parable, middle of verse 8. He affirms the master's commendation. He says, look, for the people of the world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light, God's people. Jesus is not commending dishonesty, but he is commending to us a specific aspect of the manager's actions, his shrewdness, without condoning or encouraging all of the other things this manager does. The people who belong to this world and all its values, they know how to get what they want from other people through clever planning and activity. But God's children, the people of the light, sometimes fail to see how they can shrewdly, wisely, use the things of this world for kingdom purposes and for their own spiritual advantages. The dishonest steward behaves wisely according to the world's standards and the world's values. Jesus wants his followers, he's speaking to the disciples, verse 1, to behave wisely according to the standards and values of his kingdom, but to be good managers of worldly wealth, but being kingdom shrewd about it. See, look what Jesus goes on to say. Good managers, good stewards, are shrewd. Now we find, I think, this teaching hard. We kind of recoil against it. Isn't shrewd being a negative thing? Well, Jesus says when it comes to wealth, be it. Be wise. Be pragmatic about how you use it. See, look what he says, verse 9. I tell you, use worldly wealth, the notes and the coins of this age, to gain friends for yourself, so that when it is gone, you die, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings, heaven. Now the question is, who are these friends? And there are a couple of options. Is it friends who have been saved because I have been generous with my money, because I've used my worldly wealth for kingdom purposes, and as such, there are people in heaven because of that, and they're welcoming me in? Or is it God, the Christian who stewards this world's wealth to do God's work, will have God as a friend and heaven as a home? So I need not worry about being generous with my money now. I have a home, I'm friends with God, so I can afford just to be generous with all that I have. And I think Jesus is purposefully ambiguous, because I think both are true. Either way, you're being shrewd. Either way, you're living for heaven and putting God first. See, when I'm tempted to hold on to my wealth, you know, maybe I get a significant pay rise. Or I'm just tempted to think, you know what, I just need a little more. Not much. I'm not kind of thinking I want to be right out there, you know, multi-billion. Just that next step up. You know, tempted to just have that, maybe that bigger house. I mean, we're comfortable where we are, but it'd be nice to have a bigger house. You know, maybe we're just that newer car, that flashier car, that bigger car. I mean, we get a car, it works, it's nice, it's comfortable. But it would be nice, wouldn't it, just to have that bigger car? Or maybe, you know, we go on holiday, we have great holidays, but maybe just that grander, slightly more exuberant holiday. Or maybe just the latest, modern, updated, extra piece of technology. Maybe just a little more, just to make my life a little bit more comfortable. And of course, none of those things are wrong in themselves. You see, when I'm tempted just to that next bit, the wise manager, the good manager who is shrewd thinks, yeah, that's nice. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. But do I really need it? Do I really need that extra, that next step up? After all, it's only for the now, it's only 70, 80 years, it's just stuff. Or can I use my money that's going to last in a way that's going to last forever? Use my money for eternal kingdom purposes. That actually I might be welcomed into the eternal dwellings by friends who have been saved by how I've used my money. Or welcomed by God with his words. You know, well done, good and faithful servant, because I trusted him and looked to his ways and was generous. See, the wise person, the pragmatic person, like the dishonest manager, kind of weighs up the current options against the future options. See, what would you rather have? stuff that now, that lasts for a short while, or to see friends in heaven, or to hear God's word, well done, good and faithful steward. See, a godly steward, manager, is generous now with all we have as they live in light of heaven and putting God first. Is that you? Is that you? And Jesus then goes on, he says, good managers are not just shrewd, but they're also trustworthy, verses 10 to 12. See, like the dishonest manager, we're stewarding another's wealth. He has given us much. What we have is his, whether we have much or whether we have little. And the question is, can we be trusted with it, verse 10? Character matters when it comes to our money. Failure to be a good manager, to wisely use what God has given us, is like promising God to take care of his things, but they're not doing it. It's to be like the dishonest manager. See, what's he accused of? Have a look, verse 1. He's accused of wasting the rich man's possessions, either because he's lazy, or more likely, he spent it on himself, freeloading off the rich man with no care to serve his purposes. And Jesus says, if you can be trusted with a little, you can be trusted with much. You're dishonest with a little, then you'll be dishonest with much. And I look at my own life and how often I'm like that dishonest manager. I fail to steward and manage what God has given me in a trustworthy manner. And I use that which God has given me without a thought of his purposes. I waste it away, his possessions, as it were, on my pleasures, on my comfort and my desires. See, do you steward and manage our money with God's purposes in mind or your own purposes? See, do you in effect think about how you're going to use the money that God has given you with your Bible open? You know, seeking to manage the money he's given in light of his wishes and desires. After all, it's his money. And then take into account all the Bible says about it. So I'm to provide for my family. I'm to be generous. I'm to give to the church. I'm to care for the poor and the persecuted and the widow. Do I think about all these things, or do I just plunge in and manage according to my desires? I think more often than not, I act like a kid who's been given 10 quid by mum to go and buy a generous present for their dad on Father's Day. And what do? They go to the shop and they buy a pack of sweets for themselves and stacks of Coke. And they drink it all the way home. And mum says, but I intended you to, you know, buy a present for dad generously. And of course, you could have had a packet of sweets for yourself as well. But what have you got for dad? And they say, well, I've got a pound bag of chocolate. And they think that all I've done is I've spent a pound. That's all dad needs. That the rest is mine. But they've not stewarded or managed it faithfully according to the purposes of the person who gave them the money. They've ignored it. They reinterpreted it. We got dad a present. We ticked the box. We gave what we had to. We did a minimal thing. But they're not being generous. They're not stewarded it well. They could have got dad a generous present and still themselves a packet of sweets. But they're only concerned for themselves. Jesus says, verse 11, so if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who's going to trust you with true riches? Heavenly riches, the riches of the kingdom. And verse 12, if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? In Romans 8, verse 17, tells us, look, we're going to be co-heirs with Christ. We inherit and rule with him. We get to rule his stuff with him as if it's our own. 2 Corinthians 5:10 speaks of gaining our due, our reward. And what I will receive then is measured on how I've done now, with what God has given me now. It's like this life now, with the stuff God has given me, it's like a job interview. It's an audition for what we'll be given and to do in all of eternity. There is spiritual advantage to stewarding, to managing our money well now. If you're trustworthy now, you'll be trusted with more later. You'll have true riches, verse 11. You'll have property of your own, verse 12. The wise person, the shrewd person, sees that. Seeks to be a good steward now with the little or much that they have, in order to be entrusted with more in heaven for eternity, in order to be able to serve God even more faithfully, trustworthily in heaven for all eternity. Yeah, we can hear that and we think, but isn't that just elder brother-like? You know, just stewarding well now to kind of get more stuff later. Well, yeah, it would be if it was centered on serving me and my agenda and not serving God. But the Bible does not shy away from saying there is blessing, there is reward in serving God faithfully, both now and even more so in eternity. We want to hear the words, well done, good and faithful servant. We want to do all we can, as it were, to stretch our capacity to enjoy heaven in all its fullness, to be welcomed into heaven by friends, to steward true riches and rule with Christ. Do you not want that? And Jesus is encouraging us. He's commanding us. Live with that eternal perspective. So manage your money. Manage your worldly wealth well now. Be trustworthy. Be generous. Be shrewd in light of what is to come. You're managing it for 70, 80, 90 years. You have an eternity where Jesus is promising you so much more. See, what's the wise thing? What's the shrewd thing to do? And then Jesus goes on, he fleshes out even more. He says, look, good managers are shrewd. They put God first, verse 13. See, look what Jesus says next. No one can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Jesus says it's impossible. Impossible to serve God and money. A good manager cannot be a faithful to two masters at once. One will always come on top because two masters will pull you in different directions. And here's the thing. Money makes such a powerful competitor to God's claim on our hearts and lives. Because in the end, our relationship with money is one of love and service. Because money is so powerful and seductive. We're so easily tempted to give our whole lives in service to it. You know, money can purchase access to the best food and best medicine and the best schools. It can insulate us from the ups and the downs of the markets. It can open the doors to the most exciting experiences and opportunities. It can give us a measure of safety and security and happiness that can seem much more tangible and immediate than God's provision of all those things for his people. Which is why Jesus says, be shrewd. See, be wise. See what money does and the false promises it offers and the reality that one day it will go, and see what you're left with then. See, the person seeking God is shrewd because, like the dishonest manager, they in effect see the writing on the wall. This dishonest manager knew he was about to be sacked and he acted. The shrewd, wise Christian knows that one day they will die and they will meet God, and they cannot take their wealth with them. And so they make provision for that day by putting God first now. And so they'll be generous as a way to choose God over money. It's saying, look, I'd rather invest in eternal priorities than the now. I'm going to be trustworthy with what we have. I'll seek to be faithful and honest. It's a way of saying I'm going to serve God and not money. I'm going to put his purposes first, not mine. And Jesus says it is shrewd to do so, because one recognizes that serving God and having him as our master is far better than serving money and having it as our master. Because money will ultimately always, always let you down. Even if you are the richest billionaire, trillionaire, zillionaire, if there is such a thing, there will come a day where your money will let you down. And you'll face an eternity without it, and more significantly, you'll be separated from God. But Jesus says those who serve God, who put him first, trusting Jesus, put his first ways first with the money in their lives, they're welcomed into heaven. Why? Because they're showing they love God more. They love Jesus and what he has done on the cross to save them and forgive them more than they love money and stuff. And then they're rewarded and they'll be blessed with spiritual riches and property to own. See, it's not just, you know, is that not just sound investment? It's wise, it's pragmatic, and it's shrewd. Put God first. But then Jesus says, look, good managing flows from the heart, verse 14 to 15. Good managing flows from the heart. See, verse 1 says Jesus began by telling these stories to his disciples. He's calling his disciples, those who love him, follow him, to live in this way. Verse 14 tells us the Pharisees were listening and they loved money. They did not love God. They did not serve him, verse 13. They stand in complete opposition to what Jesus has just said. They were devoted to riches and possessions, not God's will. So when they hear Jesus' teaching, they reject it. And they sit there sneering at him. They're making fun of the God who came to save them and refusing to accept his authority. But look what Jesus says to them, verse 15. You can't fool God. See, the Pharisees were brilliant at convincing people that they were holy. You know, that they were God's people. That they were good at convincing people that they were the ones who truly obeyed God's law. That they were the upright ones. That they gave generously to the poor and everyone saw it. They made a big deal about giving in the temple so that everyone could witness how generous they were, how upright they were, how righteous they were. They were so good at convincing people that they eventually brought people under the yoke of their traditions, imposing law upon law upon law upon them. And they justified themselves in the eyes of others. See, as long as others thought well of them, as long as the crowds looked at them, as long as the people thought how generous are they were happy. They sat there proudly thinking, hey, how wonderful we are, both before men and before God. Aren't we great? And Jesus makes it clear. Oh, you might be able to fool people, but God knows your heart. He sees what you truly love. He sees what you truly are. He sees the real you. He sees whether you're putting him first or you're putting money first. And he sees the real us. He sees whether we love him or money. Oh, we can fake it in front of people on a Sunday morning, maybe. I mean, we can look godly and pious and generous and we can say the right words and we can make a big deal about, yes, yes, we've given. We've given much. But he sees the real us. He sees whether I'm being generous, not just in my giving, but with all that he has given me. He sees whether I'm more concerned for his purposes and for people to be saved or whether I'm just holding tight to all he has given me, to serve my purposes and to increase my comfort and give the minimal I can to kind of tick off my duty. He sees whether I'm being faithful and managing well with what he has given me, or whether I'm kind of over worrying about my finances, holding all that I can and not trusting him to provide. So you can't fool God. God knows whether your heart is like that and holding tight, or whether your heart is like this, open to him and to his purposes. You can't fool him. This or this. Some of us this and this. God knows what you truly love. See, the one who sees our heart knows perfectly well whether you love him or your money. And you know what, you might have hoped this morning that I would have told you exactly what to spend and what proportion and how to do it. And of course you want me to tell you that because then you can tick the box. But Jesus is telling us God is after our hearts. He's after our love. He wants followers whose hearts have been made generous by the incredible generosity that God has shown them in sending his Son. God doesn't want Pharisees. He doesn't want those who look good outwardly and people think well of, but whose hearts are far from him. He wants your heart. And flowing from a heart that's captured by him, he wants you then to be shrewd. He wants you then to be generous. He wants you then to be trustworthy with what he has given and putting him first. See, the Pharisees are not interested in that. They're not interested in serving God. They just loved money. What they valued, money and people and esteem, Jesus says, look what he says, end of verse 15, God hates. It's detestable in his sight. Because you're loving that more than you love him. As one writer puts it, the heart that loves money loves an abomination that God hates. Is your heart captured by God or money? And then finally we see the good manager accepts Christ's authority, verses 16 to 18. Now if you're like me, you might have read these last three verses and thought, how does that fit with what Jesus has just said about money? I mean, it sounds like a complete 180 that Jesus just adds, which is why I think the NIV thinks is what the NIV thinks with its title, Additional Teaching. As if it's on a bolt-on. But I want to say, look, I think there's good reason to see that what Jesus says here is in the context of money. Especially as verse 19 goes on to describe a rich man and Lazarus, a kind of a worked example of the consequences of what we've been seeing in Jesus' words here. And remember, Jesus is speaking to the Pharisees who love the law, and part of their sneering is because they reject Jesus' authority. Because he's not in their mind teaching the law. You know, he's confounded them by his approach to the scriptures. On one hand, he seems utterly unconcerned to keep their rules about the Sabbath, about who to hang out with and be seen with, 15 verse 1. But on the other hand, he seems to kind of press for an even higher standard of obedience and righteousness for his followers than even the Pharisees wanted, like on the issue of money. And Jesus seeks to explain to the Pharisees that the ways in which his ministry is both a break from the Old Testament and also a continuation of it, that they might see he has authority to do and say what he is doing. That they wouldn't sneer at him, so they wouldn't reject him. So Jesus makes it clear, verse 16, the law and the prophets were proclaimed until John. John the Baptist was the last messenger of the Old Covenant era, the Old Testament era. Now that Jesus has arrived, things were going to be different. The law and the prophets described, the Old Testament that is, described a certain time and a place and a way of behaving towards God. It was bound up with the temple and the sacrifices and laws that distinguished Jew from non-Jew. And the period before Jesus was governed, regulated through the law and the prophets as contained in the Old Testament. But the scriptures, the Old Testament, also saw a day coming where there would be a new covenant, a new testament, a new promise. It operated in a context of promise, a day when things would change fundamentally. And the arrival of the Messiah, God's King, Jesus, represented the beginning of that new era. And so the old way of doing things was now defunct. Now, Jesus says, verse 16, the good news of the kingdom of God is being preached. In other words, the promise that was contained in the law and the prophets is being fulfilled. So we no longer relate to God as Old Testament believers did, or as the Pharisees wanted to, upholding all the laws and the sacrifice and temples, doing it through faith in a yet unfulfilled promise. Now we relate to God based on faith in what he did through his son's death and resurrection. And now Jesus says everyone is forcing his or her way into this kingdom, verse 16. And that little phrase can be understood in a number of ways, but the best way, I think, is not quite as the NIV translates it, but as everyone is urgently invited to enter into it. In other words, the arrival of the fulfillment of the promise, the preaching of the good news, the anointed king to change all things, means that people can now come to God through faith in Jesus. Not through the Old Testament law and through its sacrifices in a temple or keeping specific laws, but through him. And so to these Pharisees listening, Jesus is setting the challenge. Why are you not listening to me? See, all the law, John the Baptist, it all points to me. I'm the fulfillment. I'm the one. Listen to me. I'm the one with the authority. Which then, of course, raises a question which Jesus identifies. He's saying, well, is his coming then come to undermine or dismantle the ministry of the Old Testament? No, he says, verse 17, it's easier for heaven and earth to disappear than for the least stroke of a pen to drop out of the law. See, Jesus understood his arrival signaled and signified the fulfillment of the whole law. See, far from nullifying the law, Jesus was bringing it to its ultimate meaning. He was fulfilling the promises and the meanings of the Old Testament in his life, in his teaching, in his substitutionary death and resurrection. He fulfilled the law fully in his person as he kept it, and he fulfilled the law's penalty and curse when people disobeyed. He fulfilled that as well, so that those who had faith in him wouldn't have to bear it. And this law the Pharisees thought Jesus was ignoring, he said, I'm fulfilling. It then raises another question, both for the Pharisees and ourselves. Are we then free from the law? Do we just not have to worry about the Old Testament, all its commands? Is God relaxing his moral strictness? And while the Old Testament law is no longer binding, we're not keepers of the law. We don't have to keep all its dietary requirements and sacrifices. The good news of the kingdom does not mean God does not care about the holiness of his people. In fact, the opposite is true. And as such, Jesus gives an example, verse 18. He says that anyone who divorces his wife, marries another, commits adultery. The man who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. And Jesus' words here represent a more rigorous, higher ethical standard than that which is contained in the Old Testament. He went beyond what the Old Testament law said about this. He went beyond the law and the Pharisees. He went beyond what the Pharisees had added. They gave permission for a woman to be divorced if she failed to get tea on the table in time. Jesus says, no. Go about a creation mandate. If you divorce your wife, you remarry, you commit adultery. Now we have to be careful here. Jesus has not taken the opportunity to say all he has to say on divorce and remarriage. He says elsewhere there are cases where divorce and then remarriage are permissible, where there has been unfaithfulness, Matthew 19, where there's been abandonment, 1 Corinthians 7, where there's been abuse, Exodus 21. And Jesus allows divorce in those circumstances and presumably does so to allow the offended party to remarry. But that's not his point here. His point here is to demonstrate his authority as the one who fulfills the law, as the one who demands a stricter ethical standard. See, the Pharisees loved the law. They loved high ethical standards. And they didn't quite agree with what Jesus was doing. They thought Jesus was crazy about what he said on money. And of course, if he was just a man, if he was just another prophet, then his words would be crazy. And it would be crazy to serve God with the hope of heavenly rewards and trust in him to provide and give him money away generously and being good stewards of it, using it as he intended, if it was based on the words of just a man. But if the words of the one who is the Messiah, the one who came to fulfill the law, well, then his commands, his teaching are to be obeyed. And are to be kept both regarding money and marriage. See, the temptation as I listen to the parable of the shrewd manager is to play down Jesus' words. To start to say, well, he can't really have meant that. He couldn't really have meant for me to be that generous. He couldn't really have meant for me to be that shrewd, that trustworthy. He couldn't really have meant for me to kind of give up much now in order to gain more. No, can't, surely there's room here for me now and how much, you know. Jesus said, no. He's the king. His words are authoritative. He's the one that the whole Bible speaks about. Good managers accept Christ's authority. So whose authority are you going to accept? What the word has to say about money and its values and its standards? Or the one who is God? The one with all authority. How are you going to handle your money? Whose word are you going to listen to? Jesus says near the end of chapter 14 that his disciples are those who have ears to hear. Do you have ears to hear what Jesus says about money? Why don't you take a pause to ponder that as the band come up. You may have questions over some of the things that I've been saying this morning, particularly over those last few verses. Please do come and have come and ask me or talk with someone else you know, who another elder. But don't leave them there, particularly if some of this stuff is touching on where you are at this moment. Do ask your questions and do be thinking about these things. Think about whose authority you're listening to. We're going to sing a song called My Heart is Filled with Thankfulness. It's a song that reminds us actually everything is from Him. He's given us everything. So how are you going to respond in light of that? Let's stand and sing.